Listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Akwan. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, Gunapchi, Shawa, Toxic Newsom, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us on our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Conversations coming up today, Wednesday, October 8th. There is a Ways Goose on the Loose. It's a celebration of printmaking in Juneau happening this weekend, featuring a dinner, workshop, and a public fair. Megan Chambers visits with us to tell us all. The Juno Audubon Society Fall Series of Lectures kicks off tomorrow, October 9th, with the topic Hemisphere Hoppers, Alaska's Lesser Yellowlegs Project, presented by Aaron Underwood. And we'll begin today with Tessa Holes, graphic novelist, painter, journalist, illustrator, and writer best known for her autobiographical graphic novel, Feeding Ghosts, a graphic memoir, which won the 2025 Pulitzer Prize for Memoir or Autobiography. And she's also, I don't know if it's more important than the Pulitzer Prize, but it's also she's also the designer for the KTOO membership gift design this year. That's coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
And just one quick announcement before we begin today. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council is sponsoring Cleaner Fuel, Brighter Future. It's a town hall. It's today at 5 p.m. over at the Jack. And you can find out more by visiting the website seacc.org. It's going to be a town hall for concerned citizens about the detrimental impacts of a new source of water pollution. That will be today from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at the Jack. And you can also tune in online at seacc.org if you can't make it down to the Jack. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ak Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I am Boston Christopher. The Pulitzer Prize was awarded to Tessa Holes in 2025 for her graphic memoir titled Feeding Ghosts. It was in the category of memoir or autobiography. The judges praised the book as, quote, an affecting work of literary art and discovery whose illustrations bring to life three generations of Chinese women, the author, her mother and grandmother, and the experience of trauma handed down with family histories. And of course, the memoir has also won many other awards. Tessa lives here in Juneau, and KTO was honored to have her design our sponsor gifts this year with her amazing design. And Tessa joins me now in the studio. Gunathchish, Haigudi, thank you so much, Tessa, for coming in this afternoon. Wasiati, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I have to say, it kind of makes me nostalgic to watch you there with the headphones and mixing board. It brings me back to being a radio DJ in Antarctica.
So let's talk a little bit about the Pulitzer Prize. That's an amazing thing. And how does that happen? Tell us how that happens.
Well, it falls from the sky. They give you absolutely no advance warning. So I found out when everyone else did. And I was cooking in the legislative lounge for session. And it happened while I was at work. So everyone got to have a very surreal day as we all learned that simultaneously, just as session broke and all of the senators and representatives came into the lounge needing to be fed.
That is amazing. So do you not know that it – how do they find the literature? Are they just looking around for things? Does your agent or your publicist submit things?
I think generally your publisher submits, but they don't tell you.
Right, because they're submitting probably a bunch of things, and they're just, yeah, okay. So so that must have been a pretty shocking, was it a phone call? Was it an email? How did you find out?
No, they didn't even call you.
They don't call you.
They just break the news publicly, and then you start getting an absurd amount of text messages. But because all the cruise ships are in and service isn't great there, you actually don't really know what's going on. So, and I was at work, so I kind of glanced at my phone, and based on that, I thought I was nominated, which was mind-blowing enough. Rep Refridge was sitting there, and he kept looking on his phone, and he came over to me, and he was the one who told me. He's like, no, you're not nominated. You won. And that is how it all happened.
That's wild that it happens like that, that they don't even notify you before it goes public.
No, and actually I have a really charming follow-up story to this, which is that somebody in the publishing world, hearing my surprising news way of finding out, he wrote to me and he's like, oh, well, you know that when Hernan Diaz, who is an amazing author, one of my favorites, when he found out he won, he was on book tour and he was eating a fried chicken sandwich and he went out to the curb and he cried into his sandwich. And so I was like, oh, well, what a great excuse. And so I emailed him because, you know, now that's a nice thing. You get the Pulitzer and you can just cold email people.
Yeah.
And I wrote him and was like, it's probably the only two human beings who had that sandwich related shock. Just wanted to say, I love your work.
So that happened in, was it March or April? When was this?
That was May 5th. So May Cinco 5th. De Mayo for me is always going to have a different connotation.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. So what happens after, you know, like, do people start, like you said, obviously you get information, people you probably hadn't heard from in years, finding you on Facebook or texting you. But then does other things happen business-wise? Do people start reaching out or what happens?
Definitely. Everyone you've ever known contacts you, which is both wonderful and overwhelming. And then it opens a lot of doors and it feels like walking through a portal where the people who used to be your untouchable luminaries are now in some way almost your peers.
Right.
So that has been happening where the sorts of events and speaking engagements that people are asking me to do, I have to like pinch myself to be like, you want me to talk to who now and do what now?
So are you traveling more then, or will you be traveling more?
I'm trying to keep it to a reasonable scale, because something that I've been thinking about a lot of late is the difference between communities of thought and communities of place.
Mm.
And I think as a culture, we're very overextended by belonging to communities of thought. But at least for me, there's not that same sense of grounding that comes from a community of place. And I'm in a chapter where I am trying to deliberately have more place-based community and less thought-based community.
That's fascinating. Okay. Yeah. So can you give me an example of what the difference is between thought and place-based community?
Well, I think there's something that's not entirely anchored about a community of thought, because you have this intellectual or ideological level of connecting, but at the end of the day, there's no common square to tend. There's no place where you're really gathering and being in community and eating together. And I think more and more I'm realizing that for me, communities of thought, they're very inspiring, but they're also a little bit draining.
Mm.
And that sense of renewal, that's what I get from going out foraging with friends, sharing meals, going to the same sorts of events. And that was a huge part of why I moved to Juneau, was this strong desire to more deeply belong to community of place.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a conference recently and the idea of community came up and how to build that. And one of the requirements, which I thought was really fascinating, was making space, right? Making a space for that community to happen. So, like, I think of Juneau as a really great community, and it is a space, right? But maybe I'm not smart enough to figure all this out, but the idea of the community of thought is sort of a little bit ethereal in some ways and, like, doesn't have, like, a groundedness necessarily as much as a community of space like that, which would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's where I've arrived with it. I want to have a more IRL life in general.
IRL, in real life. Mm-hmm. for those who aren't up with the slang. So let's talk a little bit about Feeding Ghosts. This was a project that took you a long time to work on. 10 years?
Yeah, start to finish, 10 years. I began it a couple months after I turned 30, and it came out when I turned 39. So it truly was the entirety of my 30s.
Wow. And what inspired you to begin the journey of writing it?
I couldn't run any further than I already had. I mean, really, it was kind of almost a war of attrition in that sense, where I had this really bonkers family history. And on some level, I knew that the reason I had been born with this capacity as a writer and an artist is because my family needed me to finish this story. And I just wasn't up for that task until I knew that my own foundation was solid enough to be able to enter it. So that's why I didn't start till I was 30. And I really don't think I could have started any earlier.
Did you feel the urge to, had you been thinking about it for a long time before you started?
I think in some way I had, because there was something that was haunting me and it wasn't necessarily defined, but I knew that there was something in my family that I was running from. And it really was after my grandmother died in 2012, that's when I started to really understand, oh, I think this is it. I think this is the thing that I need to face. And so I started the book in 2015. So it was about 3 years before I really took the leap.
Interesting. And I did, you do have a website, TessaHulls.com, which where you have a bunch of different images and also other work that you've done in the past. I pulled a couple of images just so we can take a look at them here, which I find fascinating. One of them is this one, which was, I don't know if you can see that from there. This image is, if you're on the stream, you can see this image. Obviously, you can also go to TessaHulls.com. She has some of these images on there. But this, to me, is a striking image in terms of the connection between the three women that you're writing about. Can you tell me who these folks are in this image here?
Yeah, so what you're looking at is a triangular composition comprised of me, my mother, and my grandmother, with me holding a copy of my grandmother's book in the middle, and with us kind of having this entwined ribcage pattern to form an interconnected system. And I'm somebody who was a painter before I started working in comics, and so Renaissance composition with triangles, that's something I was thinking about. And I actually structured the book as a series of interlocking trios. So you have myself, my mother, my grandmother, you have America, Hong Kong, and China, and you have past, present, and future. And I'm somebody who thinks in very mechanical and structural ways. So that almost repeating fractal pattern of three trios is how I structured the whole narrative. And really the cornerstone of the book is Chinese history. And my way into it was by looking at, okay, what happened to my family, and then expanding out from there to really show how that was connected to the broader story of what was happening in China during the communist rise to power.
Wow. It's striking. It's striking imagery. It's really fascinating. I can see why you maybe won an award for it. No, it's fantastic. The other thing that I noticed on your website was there's an image on the homepage, and there's a bunch of stuff in there about talking about things that you've done and different stuff. And there's a little asterisk near the bottom, and it says, "I won't be writing another book." Tell me about the reason for not wanting to write another.
Okay, I'm going to explain this with a tangent, where hopefully some of your listeners have seen the movie Gattaca.
Okay.
Where, all right, so there's these two brothers, one of them like genetically superior, clearly destined to win, and the other one was supposed to have just failed his entire life, but through stubbornness, he's going to succeed. And the two of them would have these swimming contests, and whoever was the last to turn back would win, and always the younger brother would lose. And then one time he wins and has to rescue his stronger older brother and help him get back. And as they're on the shore, the older brother asks and said, "How did you do that?" And he said, "I didn't save anything for the swim back." And that was my approach on this book, is I gave it absolutely everything that I had, knowing that I would never have something like this in me again. So in that sense, I never was an author. I never had the slightest inclination to write a book. And this was the one act of duty my family needed of me, and I fulfilled it. So I am now going to return to not being an author.
So your first and only book at this point. You might change your mind later, but you never know.
Well, I don't think I'm going to change my mind about a book, because the thing is, for me, I know that I work in all-consuming bursts. When I am working on a project, I live in that project. It's my world. And I think that's why I know books are not something that I can do, because you can't keep up that sprint for 5 years.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of why I'm saying never again a book, is because I want to preserve my ability to be a writer and to be an artist and to do work that is collaborative and of service. And I think the sort of incendiary statement of never again a book often grabs all of the attention, so that the subtler side of that, which is I'm doing this to preserve my ability to be an artist and writer, gets lost.
Yeah, for sure. I was talking with Aeon Ivey on one of our rainy day conversations, and she was saying in some ways the same thing. Like every time she writes a book, she says she's never going to write another book. But then something calls to her and she makes it happen. But since you weren't technically, you weren't setting out to be an author necessarily, like you're saying, you were compelled to write this. You had to write this. So it might be, it's obviously different for you. So what do you then do in terms of, so because you're going to get asked that question a lot, or you probably already have, like, what book are you working on next, Tessa? And you're like, I'm not writing another book, because everybody wants to know what the next thing is. So what is the next thing if it's not a book for you?
I'm so happy to answer that, because I am working on plenty of things that are not another book. So a big part of why I moved to Juneau is wanting to create a career that doesn't exist, working as an embedded comics journalist in collaboration with field scientists. And so that's what I want to turn the skill set of my book towards, is basically a niche branch of science communication where so many people are doing such important, vital work. And the irony of having this conversation while the government is shut down. But scientists, I love you, but you're terrible at explaining your research. And, you know, I've always been somebody who has this paired backcountry and creative side, and this is essentially a way to bring those two sides of my life in concert. And then the shorter term thing that I'm working on is tomorrow I'm hosting a documentary screening of The Librarians, which is about librarians stepping in as defenders of democracy in the face of book bans, because it is Banned Books Week. So I'm giving an opening talk on the history of librarians going rogue. And it has been the most fun research rabbit hole I have gone down in years, and I have so many historical photos that will blow your mind.
That's awesome. I love the idea that you're talking about how, yeah, we love scientists, but those reports that they put out can be daunting to read or to understand. So the idea that you can take something and make put some comics behind it, right? Make some drawings and put some context to it so that people can maybe take away some of the key concepts of whatever the report might be saying. Is that kind of what you want to work on?
Yeah, ideally what I'm looking for is long-term partnerships, because making a book was way too isolating, and yeah. I really want to have collaborators and coworkers and continuity. So ideally, I would love to find some organization that would like to hire me part-time as basically a rogue storyteller for just enough hours for health insurance, just throwing that out in the universe.
Manifesting.
I'm going to manifest it. But no, I have some really exciting projects that I'm working on and some leads. So it really is coming together in some really fun ways.
That's really cool. And one of the other little project that you worked on was the design for KTO. I would be remiss if we didn't mention it. It's the membership gifts for this year. KTO is membership supported, and every year we have an artist do a design for our membership gifts. And I know you people heard it during the membership campaign. You described it a little bit, but will you talk about this design and how you came to get to here?
Yeah, I knew that I wanted to do something Juno related, obviously, and my first go-to is, okay, what is the landscape? What is the life here? And with water being so fundamental, whether it's coming from the sky frequently
right.
or on the shorelines, I wanted to do something that kind of spoke to the rich, dynamic life in the waters here. So I just thought about all of the really lovely intertidal walks that I've gone on and poking at seaweed, and so decided to do something radio related of a woman dropping recording equipment into the water and then the KTOO logo in Juneau seaweed.
And you do know that both of a few of our reporters have actually done this. They like this design because Anna Canny, who used to be our climate and science reporter, weather reporter, has done that. Clarice Larson, who's our city reporter, said she has done this. So they all like to think that it's them.
Well, I didn't know that when I did the design.
I know. That's so. What's so funny.
funny about it is that it's actually now the managing editors and stuff don't necessarily like the equipment being put in the water, but other than that, it's fantastic. So I'm so curious about the future for you, Tessa, just in terms of like how it's going to work out. I know you're talking about doing the science. What did you call it? An embedded rogue journalist? No.
Embedded comics journalist. And I think the reason I'm trying to say it that way is to, what I'm trying to avoid is being the freelancer who always just parachutes in for something fascinating for a few weeks and then never talks to that team again. Mm. So what I really want is to be able to follow the research from the field to the bench and be able to tell longitudinal stories about what these teams are doing and why it's important. And I think that's where comics, there is no better format for showing how these minute details are actually signifiers of these really beautiful, complex, and threatened systems.
Wow, that's amazing. And did you say earlier that you were doing something before comics, right, in terms of art? What kind of style were you working in before?
I was a painter.
Painter,
and
okay.
That's actually what I'm hoping this winter is, you know, knock on wood. This is kind of the first time that I've had free time and am not just scorched earth burnt out. And
yeah.
And I just got myself some new paints and I'm going to see what happens.
See what happens. Maybe we'll see a solo show somewhere in the future of that kind of work.
Or maybe I'll just do it for myself and
maybe
never
just
show anyone. but you know, that's what I used to do because
yeah.
I used to work out in Denali and I would, you know, just draw wildflowers in my sketchbook and show no one.
So what got you into wanting to do comics?
It was just for this story. I knew that it was the only way that I could tell something so complicated in a way that a reader could follow. So I learned for the book.
You learned for the book. That's amazing. And when did you start painting? Was it when you were a little kid or?
Yeah, my whole life.
Your whole life you've been painting.
Painting and writing and reading.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Tessa Hall's Pulitzer Prize winner for Feeding Ghosts, which I'm sure is available everywhere, which is great. And of course, also mentioning she'll be doing a pre-show talk tomorrow at the Gold Town for the movie The Librarians. I love the idea of rogue librarians. I don't know why that gets me, but I think that's going to be really fun. And what time is that tomorrow at the Gold Town?
It's at 6:30, and I will say that the talk involves three different kinds of camels, which absolutely has to do with rogue librarians.
I love it. Leave us with a little tease. I like that.
You'll have to come see the images.
Absolutely. Tessa Halls, you can find more about Tessa and follow her at TessaHalls.com. Gwyneth Cheese for coming in today. I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Hanson Gress. Ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin tau kanakaya ha ani kak. Gunish cheese.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In June, a small roadside grass fire started in Oregon. The fire was only about the size of a hockey rink, but a new satellite orbiting Earth was able to detect it. The satellite is the first in the FireSat program, a network of orbiting satellites that will track fires around the world.
So catch and understand every single fire, understand its growth, where it's moving, how intense it is, what its impacts can be, so that we can make better decisions over time.
Brian Collins is with the Earth Fire Alliance, a nonprofit coalition that leads the FireSat program. The group is currently testing its system. But when they launch three more satellites next year, they'll share the data more widely with first responders and the public.
So a firefighter can make a better decision in the face of a crisis event that is happening. So I'm very excited about that.
By 2030, FireSat plans to have 50 satellites in orbit, providing a near real-time view of fires burning anywhere on Earth.
We want to make sure that we don't miss any parts of the planet. We don't leave certain communities behind because they're under-resourced.
And with global coverage, FireSat would also help researchers better understand how wildfires are changing as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Oh, the kid is drowning in work that he didn't choose to do. And he knows he shouldn't be saving something, but he can't remember what or who. And he can't fix this with bourbon. Can't sterilize his friend. He won't lay it down forever. If you believe what you read online, you're gonna die bitter.
That's a little Josh Fortenberry live on the red carpet stage from his previous album, No Such Thing as Forever. It's a song called Bitter. His new album, Tidy Memorial, you can check back. We did a show with Josh yesterday. That post will be going up later today. He did some songs yesterday from his new album. He's got some album release parties this weekend. And the guest I have in the studio, it's the new album called Tidy Memorial, and Megan Chambers did the artwork for it.
I did. It was so fun.
So good cheese for that. You can check that out. You can go to joshfortenberry.com and see all that and enjoy those parties. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. A weekend of sharing knowledge, connecting, and providing access to anyone interested in printmaking is ahead with Juno Ways Goose. What's a Ways Goose? Well, we're going to find out from Megan here in just a minute. With events on Friday and Saturday, including dinners, workshops, and a public fair open to all, the organizers are calling it the first annual, so hopefully there'll be many more in the future. And as we already chatted with Megan, but Megan's here to share with us more now. Gwyneth Cheesh for coming in. Megan Wasiti, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So let's start with the obvious. What's a Ways Goose?
A Ways Goose is just a big print party.
Okay.
It's the history of Ways Goose as an event goes back to at least the 1600s, maybe earlier, but 1600s is the first documented example we have of a Ways Goose. And it was when a master printer, so think of a big print shop like churning out books or newspapers or things like that, would give his print shop the day off, all the workers, and host a big feast. And it typically took place in the fall around St. Bartholomew's Day, or when a print shop had to go from printing by daylight to candlelight.
So
that feels very on theme for this time of year in Alaska, as we have the solstice just passed and daylight savings approaching and
getting darker and darker. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So this is going to be there's a public component of this, but is some of this only for printmakers then?
No, yes and no. Some of it is only for people that are ready to get their hands dirty in printmaking.
Okay.
So all of it is open to anyone who's interested in actively printing.
Okay.
So if you want to come to the printer's dinner on Friday or the workshops on Saturday morning, we recommend that you are like, I've always wanted to try printmaking. I don't know how to start. Well, here's the place to come and figure out how to start. Or if you've dabbled a little bit in printmaking, or maybe you're an expert and you want to meet some other printmakers in town, then this is the place to do it.
Yeah, so it's the subtitle is a celebration of printmaking.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. How did this come about? How did you decide to put this event on?
Ways Goose is now, I've just talked about the history a little bit, but Ways Goose now in the modern era is really just an excuse for printmakers to get together, to network, to do have professional development opportunities. They take place all across the country and all over the world, really, for anyone who's interested in printmaking. So I've looked at attending a few Ways Gooses that are more established and have been going on for a while just to further my own practice. And then the printmaking community in the last 5 to 10 years has really flourished in Juneau.
Mm.
And it's been really fun to see. I've been printmaking myself for close to 6 years. And it was a little bit of a I love it. It's my passion and my career now, but a little bit of a lonely, isolating start because we're often just making prints in our garage or our home studio. So once I saw that there were many more people printing here and that we were not really communicating with each other, I put together a group of people that I knew who taught or who were, you know, more public-facing members of the community. Some of them own businesses. Some of them are just individual artists who are really passionate about printmaking or doing other community events related to printmaking. And I said, do you guys want to do a little weekend thing with me? Would you volunteer? Would you be part of a steering committee? And they all said yes, and here we are.
I love it. An idea to fruition, right?
Yeah.
Basically, that's kind of cool. And what do you have anything that you attribute the rise in printmaking here in Juneau to? Like, because that 5 years ago is about pandemic times. And I'm wondering, did that start people on the path of printmaking more?
Totally. I think people had the time and the space and potentially the resources to explore hobbies or crafts that they may not have before when they were doing their standard 9-to-5s with commutes. I certainly, as a printmaker, and I'm a letterpress printer, which is more involved with some specific vintage machinery, which is not very accessible in Juneau.
Mm.
I was able to learn a lot about printmaking and letterpress printing, ironically, during the pandemic because all of these Ways Gooses and letterpress workshops went online. And so suddenly, as someone in Southeast Alaska who would have had to take time off work, buy a ticket, mm-hmm. go attend a workshop, rent a hotel, suddenly I could just register for these things and go online. And so that could play a role too. That's certainly my personal story. But I mean, if we think about the political climate at the moment and the role that printmaking has played in sharing knowledge and advocating for philosophies and thoughts and movements, I think printmaking has always been a craft and an art of the people.
Yeah.
And so that could be a big reason why printmaking is accessible and interesting craft.
And it is interesting because there's different ways to do printmaking, right? Because like
yeah.
you said, some of the machinery is difficult to come by or
yes.
harder to use or to learn. But then there's other simpler ways to printmake. So is that some of the stuff that you'll be talking about this weekend?
Yep. And both during the workshops on Saturday and then also during the public print fair in the afternoon, which runs 2 to 5, we will have a lineup of presses. And you can check out everything from hand printing with a wooden spoon to all the way up to what I do, which is letterpress printing with a larger machine. I won't have my biggest letterpress machine down there because it weighs literally 1 ton and I'd have to move it with a forklift.
Wow.
But I will bring my small tabletop press, which is a condensed version and what I started printing on myself.
How do I make something with a wooden spoon?
You would carve a print form, so maybe carve a wood block. That's easy to picture. You would ink it up. You would put paper on your wood block, and you would use the back of a wooden spoon to slowly rub it, rub the back of the paper. And that's how that's still how many, many people pull a print.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
So printmaking is, you can start at home with 3 or 4 materials.
Yeah.
And a lot of trial and error. But the beauty of coming to the workshops is that you can come listen to 6 panelists who have probably, I don't know, 100 or more years of printmaking experience in the room and get all of these tips. Like, I want to hand print. Maybe you should think about Japanese paper, which pulls really nice prints with just a wooden spoon.
Okay, so let's talk about the order of events here. So Friday night at 6 o'clock, there's a dinner at the Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is these are ticketed events, except for the public print fair, which is open to all, no charge for the public print fair. But the printer's dinner Friday, October 10th at 6 p.m. Is at the Jack. It's $20. And so what's going to happen at the dinner on Friday?
The dinner is our chance to network and meet each other before we do the workshops. And that's kind of the nod to the Ways Goose, the traditional Ways Goose, which was often a feast or a party or a have dinner and go down to the pub afterwards.
I love that.
So, and it's a potluck too. I'll also add that our numbers are getting very tight for the dinner. So get your tickets today if you want to. We don't have many left.
And where do people go to do that?
Our tickets are all being sold through the Jack. Okay. And so you can either go to the Jack ticketing website or you could go to juno-waysgoose.com and we've got a link there too.
And Ways Goose is W-A-Y-Z Goose.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a love. I love it. Okay, and then Saturday from 8 to 1 at the Jack is the workshop. There are scholarships available. Yep. Are there still scholarships available
for
folks?
Yep, we do. We have at least 5 scholarships available still. The workshop registration is $40. That pays for your entrance to the workshop, breakfast and coffee and tea catered by COPA, and you get a T-shirt.
Awesome.
Which is pretty cool.
And I see topics here such as paper 101, like you were talking about, press expo, relief printing, letter press printing, a tool show and tell, and mono printing. Mono printing might come in handy for the 12x12 because it's at the City Museum, right? It's monochrome.
Oh, yeah.
Is the idea. Monochrome in color.
Yep.
Right? So, because, you can have many different shades, I guess, of one color.
But
that's kind of cool. And then the public print fair, which is, like you said, 2 to 5 at the Jack, it's open to all, and there's going to be demos and other things, right? There's going to be, fruit and veggie printing?
Yeah, so I have a toddler, and I certainly would not put carving tools into his hand.
Mm.
But I would give him an apple or maybe a potato that has been pre-carved with a star on it, cut in half to print. And so we have at the public print fair, we'll have a bunch of different stations like fruit and veggie printing, which will be great for those little kiddos.
Yeah.
You can print postcards. I'll demo the letterpress. You can print your own clothing, like bring a piece of clothing in. And we have pre-carved a bunch of different goose designs.
Cool.
And you could print, as well as other blocks that all of this printmaking community are just going to bring in and donate for the weekend. We've got a button making machine. We've also got, we'll have a sales booth. So all of these printers will bring things for sale if they want. And you can browse some really amazing prints and support the artists that are attending and participating. And then we'll have a really cool communal print where my friend Jessica, who's on the steering committee, who's a screen printer, has screen printed the poster artwork in the middle of a large sheet of paper. And anyone that carves anything over the weekend, including at an open carve station, so you could come to the public print fair and go hang out at the open carve station and carve a little block yourself. And then we'll print that on this one large sheet of paper. So it'll be like a community mural or a community large format print for the first ever Ways Goose, which will be super fun.
I love that. And I hope we have future Ways Gooses.
I mean, honestly, I was hoping for 25 people to register for this event, and 40 was like really winning. And we have 80 people signed up.
Wow.
Which is, I just am so tickled and we're thrilled and we can't believe that that people are as excited as we are. So absolutely, we'll do it again.
And you can get involved too. Juno-waysgoose.com is where you can find out more information and keep in touch. And I'm sure you have like socials and all that good stuff.
Yep, totally.
And now I'm correct. Megan will be on KXLL here at 4 o'clock with DJ Kelly to talk in more detail about this event that's happening. It's the Juno Ways Goose. It's this Friday and Saturday. And Megan, thank you so much, Gunnar Cheese, for coming in and telling us all about it. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley. And the word this week is Keich.
Keich.
That means dog. And here's a sentence. The dog is the man's best friend. Let's hear it again.
Keich.
Gunashchish Tachune Lance Twitchell, Goldbelt Heritage Foundation and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Bessie Cooley is Kokhetan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daislin, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series. She is currently translating projects for the Children of the Taku Society.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
This is Bird Note. Cackling geese may look a lot like Canada geese, but their slighter build and shorter beaks give them away as a distinct species. And one subspecies in particular has a very special story. Aleutian cackling geese build their nests on a chain of islands off the western coast of Alaska. In the 1700s, fur traders introduced an invasive species of fox to the islands, with devastating consequences for the geese. For decades, Aleutian cackling geese were believed to be extinct. But in the 1960s, a biologist discovered a group of around 300 birds nesting on Boldear Island. The fortuitous discovery allowed conservationists to put the birds on the endangered species list. And this paved the way for federal protections on their Alaskan nesting grounds and their wintering territories in Oregon and California. Thanks to this habitat conservation, there are now more than 120,000 Aleutian cackling geese, making the biannual journey between Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. To learn how to conserve seasonal habitats and protect the future of migratory birds in your area, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Joining me now in studio is Brenda Wright from the Juno Audubon Society. And via video link from Anchorage, we have Aaron Underwood. Good cheese, Brenda. How are you today?
It's wonderful. The sky is blue.
The sky is blue. We like that. And Aaron, let's test and see if we can hear you. We can see you for sure on the stream. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. You can join the Juno Audubon Society this Thursday, October 9th at 6:30 p.m. It's their annual elections and some membership announcements, which you don't have to be a member to go, as Brenda always says. But it'll be followed by an educational program that Aaron is going to present called, I love this, Hemisphere Hoppers, Alaska's Lesser Yellow Legs Project. We'll find out all about that here in just a few minutes from Aaron. Aaron is a wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Threatened, Endangered, and Diversity Program. She will share insights from ongoing efforts to track the lesser yellow legs and other information from researchers and what they're uncovering about the birds' nesting habits and more. That's again tomorrow, October 9th from 6:30 p.m. And this is interesting, Brenda, because Aaron's in Anchorage. And so this is going to be a presentation that you're doing on Zoom.
Yes, the entire meeting, 100% Zoom. You do not have to get in your car. Just turn on your computer.
Just turn on the computer. And so how do people get the link to join? Because like I said, you don't have to be a member of Juno Audubon. Of course, you can become a member, but you don't have to be a member. But how do you get the link?
It's right on the webpage, Juno Audubon webpage, under events. There's a link right there. And also under the Facebook, Juno Audubon Facebook page, there's a link there also.
Okay, great. And is this the first time you've done, well, probably in the pandemic you were doing Zoom things, but mostly you meet in person, yeah?
Yes, indeed. It's ever since we were able to meet in person that we have been doing that.
Yeah. But of course, once in a while, there's somebody like Aaron who comes along who has a great topic but lives in Anchorage and necessarily can't make it down. And so let's find out a little bit about you, Aaron. So tell us a little bit about the work that you do and then how, let's start there, the work that you do.
Oh, you cut out for a second there.
Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do as a wildlife biologist in this? I love this department that you work in, the Threatened, Endangered, and Diversity Program.
Yeah. So this is a statewide non-game program, and we work with species of greatest conservation need that have populations that are declining or under threat or anything like that. So I specifically work with the Lesser Yellowlegs Project in Anchorage, and then I also work with bats and pika, and I have colleagues that work with a wide variety of other species, from red knots, other shorebirds, to lemmings, to pollinators, to golden eagles.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. How did you come into wildlife biology? When did you start this journey?
Yeah, so I've been born and raised in Alaska. I grew up in rural Kodiak in a commercial fishing family. So I think kind of growing up in that environment, just out in the tundra and the ocean with, you know, not much else to do but explore, kind of got me started on that, which I'm sure a lot of Alaskans can relate to. So then I went to UAA for biology and got interested in birds through the Bird Treatment and Learning Center here in Anchorage, actually. They're the rehab center for wild birds. And that got me interested in them. And so I went to graduate school for it and luckily found this really amazing position here.
That is awesome. And so is there anything in particular that, was there a bird that you fell in love with that got you sort of, this is the path I want to go down?
Yeah, I know there's this one bird in we had everywhere down in Kodiak, the golden crowned sparrow, that has that very recognizable call that most people will recognize, even if you don't know what it is. It has this kind of three note, like, I'm so wary. And that was just this really beautiful, ubiquitous bird call. And they have these like bright yellow caps. So that was kind of the first bird that I really thought was, you know, interesting and cool. And then at the Bird Treatment Learning Center, I got to handle birds for the first time. I think it was a raven that I got to hold for the first time, and it kind of made it real. It was this like wild animal that, you know, we got to take care of and help. And that kind of, sparked my interest in birds. And then I studied puffins in grad school. So puffins are kind of a special bird for me too. And now I'm with the Lesser Yellowlegs. So there's kind of a variety of birds.
All right. And I do have a picture here. I have a picture of you with the, I think that's a lesser yellowleg, right?
Yeah, that's one we banded this summer.
Yeah, okay. And so let's talk a little bit about these. Is it lesser yellowlegs or yes yellowlegs?
Lesser yellowlegs.
Lesser yellowlegs, okay.
Yeah, they're kind of a companion to the greater yellowlegs.
There's a what?
There's a greater and a lesser.
There's a greater and a lesser. You mean, is one bigger than the other, Brenda?
Yes.
Oh, okay, okay. I have some other pictures here, too, that really sort of shows the yellow legs, I guess, because I'm assuming that's why they're called that. So these are wonderful wildlife photos that you took. You took these, Erin?
Yeah, I took those this last summer during our field season.
Okay. And so what is the project that you're working on with the Lesser Yellowlegs? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Lesser Yellowlegs Project has been running since 2018, and it's in Anchorage, but it's also has a branch up in Fairbanks. And we are part of a group that has projects that extend into the rest of the Americas, because the Lesser Yellowlegs has a range that goes into North and South America. So we have projects that also go into Churchill and the lower 48 and even down into South America. But here in Anchorage, we are working on looking at the survival and reproduction success of these birds. So we're going out into the field and we look for birds that have banded legs to try to identify them. And we are looking for their nests so that we can track their reproduction success.
I see. Okay. And so is that basically going to be the subject of tomorrow's talk, is all this work that you're doing to find out about these birds?
Yeah, it's a pretty large project, like I said, that kind of covers both Americas. So I was going to kind of talk about the project as a whole, conserving this bird, and then also focusing in on what we're doing here in Alaska and how all of this work relates to getting these birds up to sustainable levels here in Alaska.
Ah, I see. Okay, that's cool. And so do you have, is it like, are you gathering data, or how do you do the processing? Because I know in the picture we showed of you holding when you're tagging them, so you're trying to monitor their what they're doing, right?
Yeah, so those tags, they have little green flags on their legs that have a two-letter code. It could be LV or JA or something like that. And so when we capture a bird, we take their weight and like their measurements and information, and then we also put this tag on them. So when we go out into the field, we are mostly looking for these tagged birds to test their survival. So if we see a bird that we know was banded in 2018 and we see it again this year, then we know exactly who it is and we know that it's survived since 2018. So we're able to track their survival by finding these banded birds. And then we're also going out to areas where we know that they're building nests, and we try to find as many as we can. And they're very hard to find. We don't find that many every year, but when we do, then we can kind of track how successful that nest is, and then we can make an estimate on how much their nests are surviving in Alaska and how well they're doing with that.
Are they considered endangered in some way?
No, not yet. They are listed as vulnerable, and their populations are declining, but they are not endangered yet, luckily.
Okay. And do we know, as part of the research, to figure out like what's making the decline happen? Because I know you're studying like their reproductive sources and how often that happens and things like that. But are we attributing it to anything yet, or are you still finding that out?
Yeah, so that is one of the main goals of the Lesser Yellow Legs Working Group. And because of their large range, there's a lot of different things that are worrying the population. So there's things in Alaska, but there's also things in the lower 48 in Canada and South America. So part of this project is we are looking at how they're doing in Alaska, but then we also have branches that are investigating potential threats down in the rest of their range, and this includes agricultural practices. There is hunting down the Caribbean, shoreline hardening where habitat is disappearing, and things like that. So this is all kind of ongoing, and this project is a puzzle piece of that.
Wow. Okay. That sounds intense, Brenda.
Well, the nicest thing about a lesser yellowlegs is when they pass through Juneau, sometimes they go and stand right next to a greater yellowlegs.
Oh, interesting.
And so you can actually identify them.
Where's the best place to see them here in Juneau? When would we see them?
Well, for me, it's mostly passing through, and oftentimes it's Eagle Beach or along the dike trail, along those shallow areas where they like to feed.
I see. Okay. What time of year is that usually?
For us, they often pass through here in August.
Okay. So we've kind of missed them now, but something to look out for. Because they're really, I mean, those pictures that we were showing there on the stream, they look like really fascinating birds in terms of like their construction, right? I mean, you would be able to know because of these yellow legs. And how much bigger are the greaters than these lessers?
They're a good head taller.
Really? Okay. Yes. So that's something to know about. And do we see more of the greater or the lesser here in Juneau?
We have greater yellow legs live with us all summer.
Oh, okay.
So they don't pass through and leave. They stay with us.
Ah, they hang out. Okay, that's kind of cool. I love that. All right, so again, this is a talk that Aaron is giving tomorrow, and it's going to be via Zoom, which is awesome. You can go sign up at JunoAudubon.org. And they have an events page, and on that event page, you'll see the listing for this talk tomorrow. In addition, it's also annual elections and membership announcements. Are there some fun membership announcements coming up? I know this is the start of the fall lecture series. How often will we have more talks, Brenda?
Every second Thursday from now until April.
Uh-huh. Okay, every second Thursday. So every month on second Thursday. So you'll come back and share with us about the ones that will be coming up. And that's awesome. And then any other announcements you want to make? I know there's a cool event happening Saturday.
Yes, Saturday is the October big day.
What does that mean?
It means we want everyone in the world that likes to look at birds, go out and look at birds and then tell us what you found.
Oh, interesting.
Anywhere. Okay. Anywhere at all.
And you mean anywhere to see it?
Anywhere in the world.
Oh, anywhere in the world.
Yes. Last time, we have big migration day in May.
Yeah.
And a neighborhood bird watch in February. But this is October, so it's our big October big day.
Okay. And how do we report what we see?
eBird. It's ebird.org.
And that's an app that you get?
Yeah, you can put it on your phone. It's free. And Merlin Bird ID will help you identify it, too. And those are free also.
Oh, okay. Merlin Bird ID is a different app.
Yeah, but
okay.
they connect with each other very well because they're both made in Cornell.
Oh, that's kind of great. And you can also just take notes and then go home and go to ebird.org and do it on there that
way. Yes, or send it to a board member at Audubon and we'll be happy to enter it for you.
Oh, there you go. Okay. And is there a specific time period that you want people to be doing it?
24 hours, October 11th.
The Saturday, right?
Saturday. This Saturday.
Okay. So this Saturday, the 11th. So it's for the full 24 hours
full
of 24 the 11th.
Full 24 hours. Go out there and find those owls.
That's so fun. So Aaron, break a leg on your talk tomorrow. Really appreciate you zooming in with us here on the live stream to chat a little bit about the seminar tomorrow. It's not really a seminar. It's an educational program. Hemisphere Hoppers, Alaska's Lesser Yellowlegs Project, from when Aaron Underwood will be talking about it through the Juneau Audubon Society. Brenda, we'll see you next month. Is there anything we should be looking out for bird-wise right now?
There's a lot of birds coming back.
Okay.
The ones that will spend the winter with us, the harlequins.
Yeah.
And the green-winged teals and lots of different ducks.
Lots of different ducks. Okay, that's so cool. Thank you so much, Brenda, for being here. Gwyneth Cheech, thank you, Aaron, for joining us. Really appreciate you being on the call today.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. That's Juneau Audubon Society here on Juneau Afternoon. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. Local stories, local events, local connection made possible by you via your donation and membership at ktoo.org. Gwyneth Cheech. On tomorrow's show, a preview of this week's Evening at Egan, plus a look at the JWAC Fall Forum taking place over 2 days this coming weekend. Juneau Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juneau 104.3 and KAUK Juneau Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JuneauAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Grass, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juneau Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gwyneth Cheech for listening today. You can tune over to KXLL right now, 100.7 or 101.7, and you can check in with DJ Kelly. She's going to have more with Megan Chambers about the Ways Goose that's happening this weekend. Gwyneth Cheech, have a lovely Juneau evening.